From KCRW in Santa Monica and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
If you listen and learn, then you're going to be able to do anything you want in this town.
Everybody thinks your business is really, really all right, like
peaches and
cream.
What's with him?
Oh, I'm afraid he's gone Hollywood, Hollywood.
This week on The Business, a producer is haunted because he passed on The Blair Witch Project. Can he get a do-over with another ultra-low-budget horror film? Plus, a look back at the executive known as the Boy Wonder. But first, the Hollywood News Banter. Stay close, it's The Business from KCRW.
You can imagine Hollywood, everything is really driven by
making money.
What's with him?
Oh, I'm afraid he's gone to Hollywood, Hollywood.
I'm joined in the studio by The Business guest banterer, John Horn from the Los Angeles Times. John will be sitting in for Matt during the month of October when Matt is off on an Arctic adventure, and I mean that. John, welcome aboard.
Happy to be here.
We have a lot of breaking news this time, and we're going to have to do the best we can, taping a few days before we air. The big breaking story right now is that NBC Universal appears very much to be in play.
Coming off their incredibly good summer, too.
They're incredibly good last several years. And that's true for both the television network NBC and the film studio Universal. But not so true for those cable channels, which would be what we are assuming they are pursuing if Comcast is indeed the lead bidder for a majority of this company.
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, you assume that, you know, they would be going after the next Fast and the Furious movie, but it's really about USA and Sci-Fi and MSNBC and CNBC, those channels that you occasionally click past in the middle of the night but spit off millions and millions of dollars of profits every week.
Should it be Comcast? There was a lot of reports that Time Warner might buy it. Comcast is a huge cable provider, number one cable provider, might have a reason to keep Universal Studios alive to feed an on-demand service. You could look for a shrinking of the windows between the time when a movie is theatrically released and when you can get it on demand on cable on Comcast if this deal happens. And they might actually keep NBC around as a broadcast network because they understand that business, and broadcast, as we will soon talk about, is not dead yet.
I think the real issue is GE could owe Vivendi a lot of money. Vivendi has an ability to cash out 20% of NBC Universal, and there's not a lot of cash lying around, and they're going to need to come up with $5 or maybe $6-7 billion to take care of Vivendi. And I don't know that GE has the ability and the means to do that right now.
And GE, it has seemed under GE's ownership, NBC Universal has been something of a wounded animal drifting for a while. And, you know, things happen when animals are wounded and there's blood in the water.
Well, and it's like any market. You know, you buy low, sell high. And NBC Universal, the ratings for the television broadcast channel aren't that good. And then you have Land of the Lost, Public Enemies, Funny People, your three favorite movies of the summer.
Yeah, and that and Bruno, yeah. So let's talk about those TV ratings. TV ratings are better than expected for a lot of the new fall shows. The networks...
Except NBC.
Except NBC. The networks...
Which is owned by...
GE. NBC Universal,
sorry. You're detecting a trend here.
And so it does seem, to me, I don't know, John, what do you think, that there is some hits left in that broadcast bat, and it's a little too soon to say, you know, broadcast is dead and let's turn these networks into cable channels.
Well, I also think the good news is that scripted television is not dead. If you look, you know, more narrowly at the ratings, the Leno ratings aren't particularly strong, and the ratings for reality shows aren't particularly strong. So I think in the creative community, the people who write shows and, you know, don't just come up with concepts for how people lose weight or marry somebody they don't like, I think the people who are writing scripted television have to be very encouraged, because it's not just on the broadcast channels, it's on cable as well, that people seem to be interested in original stories.
So the other thing that's, you know, the topic A of Hollywood, we have several topic A's this week. Is that possible? I think we do. Is Roman Polanski.
The Roman Polanski story is remarkable in any number of ways. I think what is most remarkable, because we have written about it extensively at the LA Times, is the response from readers. And it is probably the most polarizing and I think in some ways significant story that readers have come across about Hollywood in a long time. I wrote a story about the case today and I had 100 emails by 10 o'clock in the morning. So people are reacting very strongly, not just to the story.
And tell us what the story
Hollywood.
Is. What's the story?
Well, the story is that Roman Polanski was arrested and faces extradition.
No, the story you had today. I mean, we all know
the
that.
The story we had today was about how it seems that Hollywood is coming to his defense and no one else is. And whether or not that represents kind of a cultural break between Hollywood and the rest of the country, or whether or not it's a we take care of our own, or great artists should be excused for their transgressions, or he's already served enough time or punishment. But it is 100-to-1 for Polanski in Hollywood and 1,000-to-1 against him outside of Hollywood.
And I do think Hollywood comes across, honestly, as a little bit soft-headed in all of this. I mean, for Harvey Weinstein, of all people, who from a dubious starting place to write a column talking about Polanski's so-called crime is... And then to be seconded by Woody Allen.
Yeah, Woody Allen would be probably the pot calling the kettle black.
I think they are both a pot calling the kettle black in different ways, I should be clear to say. They both have dubious moral platforms from which they are speaking. And I think that is these people, as you say, come across to regular folks as being crazy. So I don't think Hollywood, I guess if you're a candidate, you really, they already thought twice about celebrity endorsements. And now they might think 4 or 5 times because Hollywood looks so out of touch.
Well, and the telling thing, Kim, is that what Hollywood is focused on is the deal, the contract. What was the agreement between Polanski and the judge in the DA's office? Whereas the rest of the country is focused on the crime, having unlawful sex with a 13-year-old girl. So in some ways, it illustrates what's most important in Hollywood, which is contracts. And in the rest of the country, what's most important is the rule of law.
And that's all the news that's fit for bantering. Thanks, John.
Thank you, Kim.
Over 2 years, director Oren Peli shot creepy scenes in his house. He cut those scenes into a really scary little movie called Paranormal Activity, with an unscary budget of less than $15,000. Horror fans saw the film in 2007 at Screamfest, and that was the beginning of what you might call an impossible journey. The film is now being released by a major studio. Jason Blum played a key role in getting Paranormal Activity on this road. Formerly co-head of acquisitions at Miramax during the heyday of the Weinstein brothers, Blum had been one of many who passed on a cheap little film called The Blair Witch Project, and he's been haunted ever since. A few years later, he was a guy with a production deal at Paramount that wasn't bearing much fruit. Then, a DVD of Paranormal Activity landed on his desk, and he saw a chance for a do-over. How many times is Blair Witch invoked in this conversation about this particular film?
Because that I think should the movie turn into a phenomenon like that, that would be unbelievable. I can't think about that or conceive of that at the moment. But the reason Blair Witch was so important to my part of this story is that it taught me Blair Witch went out on cassette. It was before DVDs. It went out on cassette. Before Sundance, and all the distributors saw Blair Witch on cassette, all of us. And everyone said, what is this weird homemade movie? And no one bought it.
And just to remind everybody, this film was a $16,000 little film that didn't look like much.
That didn't look like much. And it then went on to screen at Sundance, and people, it wasn't this wildly successful screening. Everyone still passed on it. And I really internalized that in a way, and then what I kind of took away from that experience was, and it's a cliche, everyone says it, but I don't think you can really understand it until you've lived it, is that if you see something and if you really believe in it, it doesn't matter how many people say you're out of your mind, you have to take it to the ends of the earth and you just can't give up. And that was the feeling I had when I saw this movie. And I called TA the next day. I said, I have to meet this guy. They were kind enough to set it up. And so on Saturday, that weekend, Oren drove up and we sat down. And I said to him, I want to be involved with this movie. And he said, what does that mean? And I said, well, I want to come on as a producer. And this was with Steven Schneider, that we'd come on and work on it together, that we'd help him kind of tighten up the cut. But much more than that, because there was the movie that I saw there was an awesome movie, and there's and no one can really take that away from Oren. But much more importantly, that I thought that this movie should be screened in front of an audience. I had a plan, and that I thought there was a route to larger distribution than he had currently been offered.
And what year are we in? We're in 2007?
We're in 2007.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you see a plan.
Yeah, I see a plan. And he said, what about money? And I said, well, your highest offer is X, correct? And he said, yes. And X was a very low kind of six-figure amount. And I said, here's what I'd like to do. I'd like to kind of profit in success. So let me take a piece of your movie if we get starting at three times X.
So now your plan, what is the plan?
The plan now is to get it in front of an audience and get it in front of a few key press people. And I invited John Horn to see the movie, and I invited Ann Thompson to see the movie privately at CAA. And both of them loved the movie, and both of them kind of wrote, one in Variety and John for the LA Times. I couldn't have written more enthusiastic pieces than these two journalists wrote, and I'm very indebted to them for that, because this was a nothing movie from nowhere, and it was being compared.
It
was,
and it didn't have a distributor or a release
date.
It
had nothing, okay. And it was being compared favorably to Cloverfield, and I just thought that was nothing could be better, and that's how movies like this that are impossible to get distributed. That's how you get them distributed, is that you have to really build a huge case for them, because there's so much. Understandably, 5,000 of these movies are made every year. One every 5 years breaks out, right? So that's one out of every 25,000 movies actually sees the light of day. So to get...
Well, and Cloverfield had a very significant backer in J.J. Abrams.
But Cloverfield is a $25 million movie.
And a $25 million. Yeah. All of those things.
Yeah. I'm talking about like The Open Water, Blair Witch.
There aren't a lot
there,
to think
there,
of.
There are about five. The El Mariachi.
Okay, so?
So now I have these great articles, and at which point I'm thinking the phone is going to start ringing, which it doesn't. but then I do.
That shows you the power of the media, right? If you're just joining us, we're talking with producer Jason Blum about the uphill battle he fought to get the super low-budget horror film Paranormal Activity into theaters. The scary movie got buzz from a successful screening at the 2008 Slam Dance Film Festival and media praise in Variety and the LA Times. But Paranormal Activity still had no buyer. Having played at Screamfest, Paranormal Activity wasn't eligible for Sundance, but it was accepted at Slam Dance, the Sundance alternative.
And Slam Dance was going to be my big platform to get this movie into wide release.
So this would have been early 2008.
This would have been early 2008. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I took my John Horn article. I took my Ann Thompson article, and I called people, all of whom I've had long relationships with, none of whom I have even called about movies that I've produced, because I know they may not be the right home for them.
People like what sort of person are we talking about?
People who, you know, all the people who run independent distribution in the movie
companies
business.
Companies that we've heard of.
Companies that you've heard of. But there is a thing of everyone has a different style of business. But my style is that I don't call the person running the company unless if I had their job, I would say yes. Like I save those calls for that. And this was a time that I made all of those phone calls.
Let me pause for 1 second. What did you get out of the horror screening, the screening with the horror fans at CAA? Was there a payoff from that?
Yeah, the confidence to make those phone calls is
okay.
What it was. It was the confidence that I'm not crazy. I, this movie does screen incredibly well in front of an audience. And people will pay to see this movie. So I made all those phone calls. And behind the phone call, I sent my Variety and my John. I said, don't believe me. I said, read the press. And you get the typical thing that you get. We've already seen this movie, which they all had, remember? And I said, I know you've all seen it. I ran the acquisition department at Miramax. I've seen Blair Witch. You know what I mean? You got to watch this movie with an audience. And I also said, and this is something that we used to do quite a lot at Miramax, and it was Harvey who would push this, and it was very smart. If we thought, especially the kind of movie that we're talking about, a comedy or these kind of lower budget, no star movies, if we thought was a good bet, we'd do a test screening of it. We'd ask the filmmakers to borrow the print. We'd recruit an audience. We'd watch it with an audience. And I offered that. And I said, I don't want you to look at it at home. We have a new cut, and I'm not going to send you the DVD. But should you want to recruit an audience and watch with an audience, You should do that. I'd encourage you to do it. I've seen it, and I've seen the results. Anyway, I did that. I sent my articles. We had a big screening at Slamdance. I was all ready to sell this movie that I thought was going to, you know...
We're there.
Was there. And everybody passed again.
So we're back
to square one, except we have one small hope. There was a woman named Ashley Brucks, who was an executive at DreamWorks, and she worked for Adam Goodman, who was president of production at DreamWorks. And she saw the movie early on, and she had kind of the same response that I had and that Steven had to the movie. She loved it. So Ashley showed it to Adam, and Adam also loved the movie and met with Oren and I before Slamdance. And Adam said exactly what I would have said in that job to a certain degree, which is that I love this. This guy's obviously incredibly talented. We don't have the kind of distribution capability to distribute a movie. Like the cheapest movie DreamWorks has ever distributed was $30 million or whatever. We don't have an art – we don't have a searchlight or whatever.
Right. This is an art thing. Mm-hmm.
Right. But I think it's great. I think Oren is terrific. And I would have him remake it and have him – direct the remake, which was a real, I think...
A big concession.
And showed really his belief in Oren as a filmmaker. So the festival ended, and I said, Oren, I have one last idea. I said, we have to do the DreamWorks remake, but we can do this. We can put in the deal that when they find the writer or a series of writers that they think would be the right people to adapt this movie, that they'd have a test screening of the movie and that we'd have the writers come to that test screening so that they can see what part of the movie is working and what part of the movie isn't working. But I'm telling you, Oren, that if I can get a decision maker in a room with a recruited audience to see this movie, we're going to get it released somehow. I don't know if DreamWorks is going to do it, but somehow something will break. Something people will see what we're seeing. And so we did it. We did the remake deal, and
you tricked these poor writers to coming to the screening.
It was very friendly, actually.
Right.
We had our test screening, and Adam was at the test screening, and Ashley was at the test screening, and Stacey Snyder was at the test screening. And the movie screened like it had screened in front of an audience. The movie screened incredibly well. Adam tells a story of being nervous that people were leaving, that people started walking. A few people walked out towards the beginning of the movie. And I think he was sitting next to Stacey saying, like, oh, my God, this could be terrible. And then we later found out they were leaving because they were so scared. So in the beginning, everyone was very nervous. And then people settled down. And then people rode the movie like crazy. And I looked over to Oren and we kind of smiled at each other. And I remember saying to him, do me one favor. I said, when the movie ends, don't say anything. Just don't talk. Just let them talk. And the movie ended, and it was one of the kind of happier moments in this whole journey that Adam and Stacey and Ashley got immediately what was in the movie. And in fact, they began pitching us what the television spots to the wide release of Paranormal Activity would be. And the remake was not brought up, and we didn't bring it up, and they didn't bring it up. And it was this great triumphant night, which only got better 2 days later when Adam called me and said, he said, Jason, I have bad news. And I said, what? And he said, Stephen watched the movie, and he shut it off halfway through. And I was in my office at Paramount, and my heart dropped. And then said, he finished it the next day. He turned it off because he was so scared. He thinks it's one of the scariest movies he's ever seen. And he's calling Brad Gray and all that stuff. But really, all that is secondhand. So I don't really know what happened with Steven, except that he definitely saw the movie and he definitely really responded to the movie because things started rolling like they'd never had before for Paranormal Activity in the spring of 2008.
When we return in a minute, just as things are looking up, Paranormal Activity gets waylaid in a bitter Hollywood divorce. You're listening to The Business from KCRW. We'd love to know what you think. Write to us at thebusiness@kcrw.com or go to the comment page for today's show at kcrw.com/thebusiness. This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. Paranormal Activity is an ultra-low-budget horror film that played great at the Slamdance Festival last year. After DreamWorks acquired it, the movie seemed to be on its way. Then, all went silent. It turned out that the movie was caught up in the bitter split between DreamWorks and Paramount. Luckily for the filmmakers, the two DreamWorks executives who had first championed Paranormal Activity landed at Paramount, and they kept the movie alive. The studio started to roll out the film this fall with midnight screenings in college towns, hoping that the screams would lead to positive word of mouth. We're talking to one of the film's producers, Jason Blum. Paramount came up with that idea of these midnight screenings in college towns. Did you think you're genius? Or, I mean, I realize it's politic for you to say yes, but was there part of you saying, oh, midnight screenings in college towns, why?
The egomaniac in me would say, like, I wish they released it on 3,000 screens over the weekend. And the more kind of steady, thoughtful person would say, there's a very good chance that the movie couldn't withstand that. The short answer to the question is, I was thrilled when there was a plan.
And any plan.
Any plan. And my background is not distribution. So I trust that those people do that every day, all the time, for many, many years, that they know what they're doing with this movie. And they've done something which, you know, which hasn't really been done with movies before, which is the just demand it feature. So if you're living in a town and it's not showing, you can go on the internet and demand it. And
yeah, and how does that work? I demand it and I live in Dubuque. What happens?
I think yeah, you get to a certain threshold, a certain number of people. When there are a certain number of people from a certain city hits on a demand that it shows, your vote shows up, and they'll open the movie in that city.
So you have people going around on a bus going like, we're going to tomorrow we go to Trenton and everybody demand it?
No, we don't have to do that. No, because they see on the internet, like Twitter and stuff, and like, how do I see this movie? Well, if it's not playing in your city, go to demand that it does.
But, and what's the threshold, you know, to get demand?
Well, I think it varies a little bit because it wouldn't be fair to pit New York against St. Louis, so I'm not exactly sure what that is.
But if it hits a certain number, it will come and be screened in your city.
It'll play in your city, yeah.
Very unusual.
Yeah.
Is this a model for anything, or is this just one of those flashes that, you know, comes along, as you said, every few years?
I think that is a premature conversation.
Because we don't know what's going to happen.
We don't know.
But I mean, you've already done, in fairness, better than you necessarily had reason to hope.
I couldn't be happier with just getting here.
I mean, bearing in mind that you haven't hit the big, lotto jackpot, but you're with a movie that cost either $10 or $15 or something in between $1,000. That's, you're doing pretty good.
Yeah, this gives me immense satisfaction.
You're showing me the Paramount homepage on your BlackBerry, and there is the Paranormal Activity little promotional box, right?
So even if we go no further, that feels pretty good.
Jason Blum is a producer of the low budget horror movie Paranormal Activity. Other credits include The Reader and the upcoming film The Tooth Fairy with Dwayne Johnson and Ashley Judd. Thank you.
Thank you.
High def camera on. My girlfriend Katie, she thinks there's something in the house. I don't know.
You believe me, right?
I think we're gonna have a very interesting time capturing whatever paranormal phenomena is occurring or is not occurring.
Windows and locks, doors and locks, alarm is on.
If you watch the Oscars, you may have seen the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences give out the prestigious Irving Thalberg Award. It isn't given every year. It's reserved for producers who have created a body of quality work. But have you ever wondered, who was Irving Thalberg? Now there's an exhibit at the Academy in Beverly Hills to answer that question. It explores the impact of the executive known as the Boy Wonder. Thalberg was born in Brooklyn and was always in frail health. But that didn't stop him. Soon after he finished high school, he got a job working for Universal Pictures founder Carl Laemmle. By the time he was 21, he was running production. The Academy's exhibit includes letters, photographs, and memorabilia that capture Thalberg's ferocious energy. There's a makeup case used by Lon Chaney, one of the stars whose careers were guided by Thalberg. One of the most revealing items comes at the beginning of the exhibit and at the beginning of Thalberg's career. In 1922, the then 21-year-old Thalberg wrote a letter firing auteur director Eric von Stroheim from the film Merry-Go-Round. Thalberg biographer Mark Vieira, who curated the show, reads Thalberg's blunt message.
In spite of the fact that you have occupied a position of trust, dignity, and confidence on the lot, you have time and time again demonstrated your disloyalty to our company, encouraged and fostered discontent, distrust, and disrespect for us in the minds of your fellow employees, and have attempted to create an organization loyal to yourself rather than the company you were employed to serve.
It might be easy to imagine a studio executive telling off a temperamental director nowadays, but then directors were king.
Well, Thalberg changed all that, and it really established the precedent of the omnipotent producer.
So this is maybe a shot heard around Hollywood?
Yes.
Was there a shocked reaction?
Not long afterwards, directors such as Maurice Tourneur, Emile Chautard began to leave and work in Europe.
Oh, so he really drove, could argue he drove some talent away from...
He did, yeah.
A couple of years later, Thalberg joined Louis B. Mayer in the company that became MGM. Thalberg was a hands-on executive who supervised every aspect of production. He had an instinct for storytelling and for making stars. One triumph was rescuing the troubled Ben-Hur, a blockbuster in 1925. Artifacts from the film are on display at the Academy, like a leather vest worn by star Ramon Navarro. But Vieira says Thalberg's hard work took a toll on his always fragile health.
He worked so hard in the editing that he had a heart attack at age 26.
Thalberg wasn't daunted by illness or powerful directors, and he wasn't afraid to push his stars. One of the biggest and most powerful in the MGM firmament was Greta Garbo. But she was nervous about making her first talking film. Did Thalberg have to push her?
He said, "I will stop her paycheck if she does not cooperate."
Soon after, Thalberg made more Hollywood history when he cast Garbo in Grand Hotel.
This is the first all-star film where he put five stars in one movie, and we have John Barrymore, his brother Lionel Barrymore, Wallace Beery, Joan Crawford, and Greta Garbo. And it had never been done before. It was considered just a crazy idea, and it was a huge, huge hit.
I assume it was expensive then as it would be now, although now probably less expensive than it would have been like a year and a half ago.
No, because under the studio system, everybody's under contract.
After Thalberg suffered a second heart attack in 1932, Louis B. Mayer ousted him from MGM, motivated, Vieira says, by jealousy and greed. Still, Thalberg went on to produce great films, like Mutiny on the Bounty, and one of the Marx Brothers' finest, A Night at the Opera. And he threw himself into creating an elaborate Romeo and Juliet, hoping to give his wife, actress Norma Shearer, her greatest role.
He got every expert on Shakespeare. They went to Verona and shot every building. They brought everything that wasn't nailed down. Anything that was, they took a picture of it. So they got this amazing production. They couldn't quite reach the public with this kind of a project at that time. It just was too exotic. And this was the film that Thalberg really wanted to succeed. And when it did not, for the first time in his career, he had a failure that he cared about.
While he toiled on Romeo and Juliet, Thalberg was at work on several other lavish productions.
The combination of the overwork and the depression that followed this disappointment of the reception of Romeo and Juliet conspired to make him ill. And he was dead within a week.
Thalberg was only 37 years old. Vieira says Thalberg's greatest contribution was his desire to make movies that were a cut above.
He felt, okay, people are going to come and see a movie. They're going to take what we give them. Why can't we give them something better?
Is there anybody who, in the history of the business, that's had the impact in such a short time that Thalberg did?
Of course, he was at the right place at the right time. No question about that. He was in an industry that was wide open. And he also believed he was going to die, so he wasn't afraid of anyone.
Fearlessness and pursuit of quality, that may be the biggest artifact in the Thalberg exhibit. Irving Thalberg, creating the Hollywood studio system, is at the Academy through December 13th. And that's The Business. Matt Holzman produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. Darby Maloney is our associate producer. Our theme music, Mashup, was designed by beat architect Jason Grohman. The Business is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica. If you have any questions or comments about the show, write us at thebusiness@kcrw.com. You can also listen to this or any past program and comment about the show at kcrw.com/thebusiness. You can listen to our podcast, share it with a friend, or embed it on your blog with a click of the button from our new media player at kcrw.com. And you can always subscribe to the podcast through iTunes. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.